You dickheads.
Welcome to episode 41 of Double Dodge. This one we're calling Jankalier, as that will become apparent once I have that conversation. This time we thought we'd have a chat, given that everyone else was with Steamforged, and we don't like missing out on anything, with one Bryce Johnston. He is a champ, he's part of the development team, you all know who he is, so I don't really need to do an intro. And we thought we'd talk about, obviously, the new captains coming out. There's a bit of fun there. We talk a bit of Jank, a bit of the design component, and what kind of gaps they were looking to fill with them. We also do move on to the elephant in the room, which is the miners, where they're sitting. Steamforged have basically stated that they're still analysing the data. They'll probably do some testing over the next month and want a little bit more data. So Bryce and I talk about that. Obviously, he can't go into too much detail, but in terms of where they're at, we have a good little chat about them. So I hope you enjoy it, and we'll just jump on in. Yeah. Mm.
Do you like Germans? Of course you do. They've got loads of them. They're like kept in a box or something. I don't know. It's a bit weird.
And on the line, we've got one Mr. Bryce Johnston. He's leader of the free world, or head of the family. I'm not sure what the title is on Longshanks. Outstanding in the field and in the bed, apparently. How you going, mate?
I'm doing pretty well, actually. That's a hell of an intro. I really wish Farmers was a leader of the free world. That would be better. That'd be a much cooler title, because head of the family is pretty good, but
it's not bad.
If I was like leader of the free world, like what little of it I guess there is left.
Yeah.
Currently,
but, well, I mean, yeah. As soon as Scotland kind of breaks off from the rest of the United Kingdom, I think you'll be fine. That essentially will be the free world where you're from, anyway.
Yeah. Mm. That's all we're waiting on.
Yeah, sorry, I know that's probably salt in the wound. Hey, I did have a Scottish question for you, actually. Kind of. Can you explain to me, because we interviewed this guy the other day, and Steve Easton has a Scottish flag on his Longshanks listing. How Scottish is Steve Easton?
He is... he owns a flat in Scotland.
So legally Scottish then, mate, or legally like associated with Scotland.
Interesting tidbit, actually. Easton used to work because he actually used to live in Ayr, which is near where I grew up. And when I first started like playing miniature games, like when I first started going to Games Workshop when I was like 14, Easton worked at that Games Workshop. So it's kind of weird. Like I've kind of actually known him since I was like a kid. And then, like, later on, obviously, we got into War Machine and Guild Ball, and, like, he moved away from Games Workshop and got into those. So it's a bit odd that I've known him, like, as I first knew him as a Games Workshop staffer, like, 13 years ago or something.
I mean, do you need me to stop the recording? And if you want to tell me anything that he did or touched you in any way, that's fine. We can, or I can keep recording and we can just submit it to the police.
No, he was grand. He did once build me a high elf list that was 500 points over, but that's just fairly standard Easton stuff.
Well, I was going to say, isn't that standard Games Workshop? They're just trying to sell you more. It's just 500 extra points.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that was like an extra like 90 quid or something. Like, just trying to pull it out of this like. This naive 15-year-old at the time.
Oh, he's got a little bit of money. We'll just see how much we can sneak out of this child. Fantastic. Brilliant. So we've got you on the line, given that you're the leader of the free world, and we thought with all the fantastic next wave of captains that we'd have a chat about that and talk about the design kind of component and whatnot. Maybe we'll just go through the document that you've sent me. That way we've got them in the same order. This is really interesting. The first one I find quite fascinating because I believe from the outside looking in, this would have been a challenge to build. So we've got, obviously, Cutlass, Yep. And then Cutlass's offsider, so to speak, or in the reverse, Culverin, is that how you pronounce it?
Culverin, yeah. It's a type of, a Culverin was a type of like medieval cannon.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant.
Yeah.
Mm, a little bit of tech there. Oh, yeah, so I
feel like we do our research, like, you know, we put hours into this stuff.
Yeah, like Diggy Hole. I mean, I love that. Like, I love that on so many levels, but I honestly think some people just don't even get that one.
Yeah, I think that one works because, like, Diggy Hole is, like, if you don't know it, you're kind of like, okay, they're digging a hole and placing. But if you do know it, then you have the song stuck in your head for the next infinity billion years.
Oh, I'm there. Absolutely.
Yeah. It was actually funny at French National. It was like we were sitting eating dinner one night, like, because it was like a buffet, like, dinner thing. And I just heard from another table someone's phone playing Diggy Hole. And I was like, oh my God, I cannot escape this song.
Well, you are part of the design team. So, you know, who are you going to blame at that point?
That's true. That it is. Well, actually, that was Berkin's fault because he loved that song. And during Miner's development, he pretty much just played that song in the office. Constantly.
Why does that not surprise me?
Yeah.
My word. All right. So, Culverin and Cutlass. This is obviously the first master and apprentice built at the same time. I guess from the outside looking in, bit of a challenge. What were the challenges design-wise to actually, you know, create these two kind of models, especially when one of them had kind of been, you know, based on the Free City draft, have been, you know, pushed into the guild more than selected by you guys.
Yeah, so it was actually a bit of an odd one because we originally intended, we thought Gaffer was going to win for blacksmiths.
Yep.
So we were like, okay, blacksmiths have one more apprentice than they have masters. So Gaffer will come out, he'll be a new master, grand, job done.
Done.
And then Cutlass won, and it wouldn't have felt right, Cutlass being a master, because like Gaffer obviously's got that kind of age, that experience, and really that didn't work for Cutlass's character. And the second part of that is that she was supposed to be a goalkeeper during the 3-6 draft, but in the initial sort of design of her, we kind of talked about it, and blacksmith apprentices, because of the kind of very skewed way blacksmiths work, blacksmith's apprentices are the ones that actually go out and score UVPs.
Yeah.
You know? So that actually didn't really work because, like, a goalkeeper traditionally is sort of tied to the goal.
Yeah.
And has a lot of ways of, like, disrupting people taking shots or raising the TN or whatever. But that really didn't feel right for blacksmith apprentice because they need to actually be able to go out and kill things. Or like score goals or whatever. So for Cutlass, we basically split the goalkeeping stuff between her and her master and Culverin, and that was the first thing that we kind of had to deal with making these models was that, like, because Cutlass was going to be apprentice, we didn't want the blacksmiths to have two more apprentices than they had masters. So she was always going to come with an extra master for blacksmiths.
Yeah.
And then the goalkeeping stuff would be split across both of them.
It's a fascinating development. So basically Culverin was purely developed looking at Cutlass and what kind of theme or what flavour based on the Free Cities draft that she'd kind of brought in essentially.
Pretty much, yeah, because Cutlass had that kind of piratey privateer aspect to her and very much came from the sea. Again, kind of thought Cutlass might end up in Fish, so we were kind of hoping for that one. But I think going down the route of, like, you know, ships' cannons and ships, like, obviously have, like, ships need a lot of mechanical stuff as well.
Yeah, and, exactly.
And of, like, forging cannons was the kind of clear route that we had there. And so I think we managed to fit that into the Blacksmith Guild pretty well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So one of the other things I've noticed, I mean, I won't go through all the stats of them. Obviously, Culverin's got quite a master's, you know, playbook, very support-based.
Yeah.
Got the I Spy and then getting a goal for the, you know, her goalkeeping component. But when you look at Cutlass, a lot of it is tied to Culverin. Was it intentional to tie them closer together as master and apprentice? Because when we look at other ones, they can be taken more often with, you know, other apprentices. It doesn't have to be taken with their immediate one, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah, basically, yeah. It was something we wanted to try as a kind of an interesting design thing, because you can take Culverin without Cutlass.
Yep.
Because, like, she like, the masters tend to be more interchangeable in terms of, like, you know, they bring some buffs, they bring some auras, they have a playbook that is good at generating momentum, but not good at actually, you know, doing damage or anything. So I think you can play Culverin without Cutlass, but we wanted to try out an apprentice where we basically push the risk-reward element of it. So, like, Cutlass's character plays are better in quote marks and inverted commas than most character plays, most squaddy level character plays in the game are allowed to be.
Yeah.
But the trade-off is if Culverin gets taken out, she doesn't have any character plays.
Absolutely.
So you're really pushing that risk-reward element with them, which I think is a really cool aspect.
Yeah, no, I think it's fascinating. Is it something in hindsight that you were trying to do with the original blacksmiths, or is it just more a design space that you thought would be interesting?
Yeah, no, it's definitely a design space we thought would be interesting, because the intention with the original like core 12 blacksmiths was that you would be able to mix and match apprentices and masters. Yep. And like you got rewards if you took the correct apprentice with the correct master, but it wasn't intended to be quite as like split down the key lines of you have to always take like hearth and alloy, for instance.
Yeah.
But because we tried to do that with the initial ones, Cutlass was a bit of design space where we can go, well, actually, we can just tie her very tightly to her master, especially because the last apprentice we did, Cinder, like veteran Cinder, isn't really tied to any master. So it was almost a reaction to that.
Yeah.
In terms of what we wanted to do for blacksmiths and design space we wanted to explore.
Yeah, no, it's really fascinating. And I was just having a quick look at Culverin as a standalone master. Still really powerful, especially from a defensive point of view. If you take her just as a master on her own with the legendary, mm-hmm. you know, obviously the condition removal, and then if she's captain, you get the HP as well. I can see a real grindy kind of defensive game. And because Culverin's got the get in the goal, you could still kind of have a pseudo keeper set up with anyone anyway.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And you can sort of set her back and she can sit within 4 inches of the goal and put up, like, get in the goal and I spy out to 6 inches away. Or, like, if there's another master that's hanging back or hell, any model that's hanging back, you can put get in the goal there and move her up a little bit for I spy as well.
Yeah.
Which is also why her support thing, because, you know, all masters have, like, singled out or stagger, or gain plus two net hits or something.
Yeah.
And hers is ranged because of that. Like, she's intended to be able to hang back a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But the trade-off is if she hangs back a bit more, you're not using those awesome character plays from Cutlass because they have to be measured from her. So it's the whole, like, there's a lot of push-pull going on in these models, which is something that we try and explore. Like, you want a model to be in two different places at once, almost. And a lot of that's like, wait, how good is your positioning to get that out of those models, you know?
Yeah, I mean, if you're within four, if Culverin's within four, and you're shooting all your plays off her, you know, your chain shot's only getting to, like, the halfway line or just over. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I really like that. I think that's really cool. I mean, for all the punters, you've maintained Cutlass with, you know, a ridiculously high damage result right at the top. I love that.
Yep.
And especially with
classic
play it is, isn't it? But, you know, once again, the influence cap kind of manages that. So she's got the, you know, the 1-3 influence. So you're not going to get a ridiculous amount of punches out of her. But I guess with Ice Spy and Tutelage.
She kind of has effectively, like, removing that one influence cap gives her tutelage, so she gets to, if she wants, knock someone down and do 3 damage.
Yeah.
And, like, if you look at that as that's an attack, if she made a non-momentous 3 damage knockdown result, that's pretty good.
Yeah. And then, you know, tooled up and the rest of it, you know, tooled up Ice Spy or whatever, you'd start to get into that silly world again. So, no, I like it. I like it. I love pirates. I always wanted to be a pirate. So, you've definitely kicked a goal with this one. Love it.
Cool.
So, shall we move on to Corker, I think is the next one.
Big lad.
Crumbs, I mean, you would have met guys that look like this up in Scotland. I mean, that's half of the population.
We exclusively look like that. Corker was just, we basically just took the artist into the middle of Glasgow on a Saturday night and we're like, what do you see?
And come back and alive.
And that's what he created, so.
Brilliant. So, I guess, you know, once again, the old design space, but, you know, what with this model, did you look at the guild and go, okay, what do we need? What do the brewers need? I mean, I know brewer fans seem to complain that they don't have anything of everything or everything of anything. What did you feel that they actually, you know, needed, and where did this guy fit in?
So it was slightly less of what they needed and more of what design space we can explore.
Yep.
And we thought the beer tokens on Pintpot were like a really cool aspect of design that we hadn't really gone any deeper into. And so we were like, right, what if we made a captain that can just hand out beer tokens? And the other key thing about him is he has a damage buff for himself, but he doesn't have a damage buff for the team. Like, he doesn't have, like, tap, you know, because Tapper's first activation is, like, walk up, knock down two people, put up commanding aura, heroic some influence onto someone else. You know, like, he does a hell of a lot there. And Corker is more kind of, like, he puts up Whiskey Chaser, he puts up Tough Skin. If he can get in range of someone, he can hit them, but he is only, like, 5'7 with a 1-inch melee zone is not quick.
No.
You know? And then he's, like, it's a little bit like Vet Boar, his design, in terms of he doesn't bring a damage buff, but his team gets to make more attacks because you can have up to, like, effectively 5 influence on Hooper with 3 bar or 6 influence on Vet Decimate, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And so all of a sudden it just dials them up. I know I'm a bit slow. I've only just realised that's a heroic play, so that's even better. So you can just basically free bar every round.
Yeah,
that's kind of okay.
And it's really good because it effectively gives you, like, if you go on turn one and free bar onto like himself and 4 other models, it's effectively giving you like 5 influence that you get to carry over into the next turn.
Yeah, no,
which is super cool. Like,
it's pretty good. I mean, obviously his influence stat reflects that though, right? So, you know.
Yeah. There's a reason he has the lowest influence stat of any captain in Guild Ball.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same as the farmers. Like, if you bring too much and then you're generating in between turns, then all of a sudden it just blows out of proportion. So.
Yeah, exactly. Like, farmers is one where a typical farmers team now brings like a maximum of 11 influence, really, unless you're running like Grange and like 3 planners. Actually, even then,
no, it's not.
Even if you're on Grange and all 3 planners, you're still only generating like not all 3 or 4 planners. You're still only generating.
You get to 12, then, don't you?
Yeah, you get to 12, 13 from the mascot, and then your team's not doing any work because it's planners.
No, exactly. You've got all this influence pushing people around and doing nothing.
Yeah. So I think it's definitely a similar thing with farmers, where like the team only brings like 10 or 11 influence, but because you get those like free influence over the turns with harvest markers, it's much the same with Corker.
Yeah.
So his team will generally bring 11 influence. But then you can generate, obviously, a ton more through the beer tokens.
Yeah, absolutely. So, the beer tokens, sorry, I'm just... Where is it capped per model? It's on the guild card?
Yeah. So, basically, beer tokens have become a guild rule for brewers. because the alternative was to print a hell of a lot of text on his card explaining beer tokens again. And we were basically like, we can just fix this and just put it as a guild rule on the guild card.
Yeah.
So models are capped at two, unless they have a special rule otherwise, which like Pint Pot does.
Yeah.
So he can get refilled up to six. Not that I think you'll ever, because he can spend three in a turn and you can only give him one per turn.
Yeah.
So
he's not.
It's unlikely.
Not going to refill. Sorry? He's not going to refill very quickly, and you're probably going to spend him first. But I do like the idea that you could fuel up your side in the first couple of turns, and then have a turn of, you know, effective, influence of like 20 odd.
Yeah. If you can set it up, you can just go ham on like turn three.
Yeah.
Basically, you can only have a maximum of two at any one time. You can spend three in one turn is the core guild rule. So that's Cork. Like, you can do it with Corker himself on turn three if he heroics on both turns one and two and doesn't spend any. And then during his activation on turn three, he spends two and then heroics.
Ah, okay. And gets another one.
Yeah. But it's a bit weird because on particularly on turn one, he wants his entire team to be within four for free bar. And then he also wants his... basically his whole team to be within four of Spigot for Times Called. So his position, like, it's one where on paper, like, the raw set of numbers are obviously really, really good, but like, you don't get to play with your entire team within 4 inches of your cap.
It's a clusterfuck. Absolute clusterfuck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, and you'll just lose to like Fish and like Order and fast goal scoring teams if you just you spend your entire time being like, I'm going to have a turn where I get 30, like, I get 20 influence. This is so awesome. And the Fish are like, yeah, we're two goals up.
The game's over. Yeah, exactly. Two goals up. We've won the momentum race, so I'm about to score again. Fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. Because if you don't use your beer tokens as you go, you're only running with 11 influence.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. So that's an interesting point that we touched on with the farmers. Is it something you've looked for in guilds, or is it a reaction, I don't know, to things like the farmers, because they were one of the first guilds that had kind of another resource? But we've seen, like, the alchemists have the resource of a condition to strip off. Is this tied to that, or it was just more, we like the beer tokens, it wasn't necessarily because it was that added resource, it just adds that extra kind of dimension to them?
Bit of both. Actually, like, we always really liked the beer tokens, and it was kind of a thing that we always meant to use somewhere else as well, but it didn't feel right to use it until we had like a captain basically that we could tie it to. And the other point was that we definitely were more inspired, like, farmers sort of and the additional resource started us down a train of thinking that obviously season 4 alchemists have, where they get to just spend conditions for free stuff. And now brewers kind of get beer tokens. So, like, introducing essentially third resources to guilds is a really interesting sort of mini game that we get to play. And that's definitely something that we're keen to expand on kind of going forward.
But like, not necessarily going to happen for every guild. Like, I can make the assumption you don't want to, you know, basically make the promise that, oh, we're going to look at it for everyone, but, you know, some guilds it's not required, or it wouldn't actually, you know, fit thematically.
Yeah, there's some that wouldn't fit, there's some that just don't need it, like Butchers, you know, they don't need another resource. Although, it's kind of interesting, because their extra resource, if you like, is on Vetbora, and it's just giving them Berserk, or giving them Furious. It's just making their existing influence more efficient.
Rather
than giving them, like, you know, pulling bleed off a model to make an attack or something. Like, I don't think that's necessary in Butchers, whereas it feels much more thematic in Alchemists. And, like, a lot of it is depending on whether we think we can make a thematic one that works for the guild. And obviously beer tokens are, like, super relevant and super thematic for brewers, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you could have sausage tokens for the Butchers. You just hope, like, each of them comes with, like, a six-pack of sausage tokens. Or every time they kill someone, they effectively put it through, like, a meat grinder and turn them into the sausages. I mean, there's, you know, there's definitely space there, but I think from a power point of view, definitely not. I don't play them, and I don't intend on playing them, and I hate, you know, I haven't experienced the vet boar to his full potential, and yeah, I don't really want to, so don't give him any sausages.
Okay, no sausages for boar.
No, fair.
That's the big takeaway, is that boar will remain sausageless.
Well, maybe that's why he's so angry, like he dropped his sausage or something.
He's just so mad, he's just hungry.
Oh, yeah, probably. Yeah, that's why he's trying to kill everyone, yeah. to make him into sausages.
Yeah. Oh, wait, is boar, like, confirmed cannibal now?
Yeah. You heard it here first.
He's coming to the bench and he's like, I'm eating one of yous.
Yeah, who's first?
One of yous is going in my belly.
I love it. Corker, fantastic. And this one, yep. I love the artwork and the model. It like just looks wicked. And I think it just works in so well with, you know, that Brewer's aesthetic as well.
Yeah, I think this is one that Doug and Ross, like the artist, actually, I don't know if Ross sculpted this, because Ross now obviously has a sculpting team.
Mm.
But the sculpting team and Doug, the artist, have knocked out the park on this one.
Yeah, it's spectacular.
Yeah.
Love it. So, shall we move on to a rivet?
Yeah.
Now, let's get on to rivet. From an engineer's point of view, I love this. I love everything about this model and cannot wait to get it in my hands.
I think she's so cool.
I know I've asked about, you know, what design space on other models. This one, to me, feels like you did find a spot in terms of, obviously, momentous damage and kind of maybe more scrummy style kind of game the engineers want to play. Is that relatively true with this model?
Yeah. It's like the third bit of engineers that they've kind of always missed is like good momentous damage, really, with the exception of, like, there are certain models, like Ballista has like decent momentous damage.
Yeah.
But Rivet is the kind of third pillar, because you've got Ballista, who's like ranged, like control flexing into, like, he can kind of score goals, he can kind of get takeouts, like he's very flexible. Pinvice, again, can kind of get takeouts, but is more skewed towards goal scoring, but loses some of the control aspect.
Mm.
And then Rivet is just, she's very much like a melee scrum team support. And also, like, she can do some pretty damn good damage herself as well.
Well, that's an interesting point, because I was just looking at that. I mean, you know, I've played a lot of engineers, and you generally don't see with engineers momentous, you know, two on the two column. It's usually higher.
Yeah.
I believe Harriet's got it, and that's about, I think, Harriet, it.
Yeah, Harriet has two on two, and then after that, engineer playbooks tend to have two damage on three.
Three, or if they've and got it, also, I think Ratchet's got two on two, but it's not momentous. Something like that.
Yeah, and also, like, you'd never want to be really making attacks with Ratchet. Like,
no.
Which is, like, he actually has pretty decent playbook. Like, if you look at his actual playbook, where is his card?
Yeah, when he goes in, this is what I've learned playing him. In a turn that he absolutely has to go first, if you've got something that needs to happen and you need the tooled up, overclocked, you know, conditional removal or whatever, then often I'll actually load him up, because if someone's got a crowd, tack six, he can actually get a bit of work done. And then you throw out the tooled out.
Yeah, because you can hit with a crowd at death as well. You can either hit that non-momentous two or the momentous push, or if you spike up to three hits, you get the mom two damage push.
Yeah,
on three, which is like just a cracking result.
Yeah, no, he's. I think just because of his victim nature, you don't tend to push him forward. But I've found that there can be like turn three situations where if you've won initiative. And you want to get, you know, load up the team or kind of show some threat in certain areas. So throw a tool up and are overclocked out just to either, you know, fake someone out or you know, show where your power is going to be. He's really good to actually put two or three on and just even, you know, generate that one or two momentum to then fuel the team for the rest of the turn.
Yeah, for sure. Like, it's, I think a lot of people don't realize his playbook is actually pretty decent because he's a model that you're like, This model will sit by my goalpost, and he will pull someone up, and he will overclock, and he will maybe throw out a blaster, and that is his purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. And You know, yeah. I guess they're missing that. So then, I mean, you know, with him in mind, if you bring Rivet into the game, elbow grease with the momentous damage, all of a sudden, now I'm not saying you're going to put it on him, but you've got an option to get him to, you know, momentous two on the two.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the big winner from it, or one of the big winners, is Colossus as well.
Absolutely. He's like,
he's got that four damage on the top end of his playbook.
Yeah, I know you guys probably hate the term auto include, but I can't see a world where you don't take Colossus with her purely because of elbow grease and, you know, and toe as well. Not to mention follow my lead where everyone's like tactics. Because tactics on Colossus just makes him that much better.
Yeah, it's just that extra little, like, a lot of engineers have that, where, like, it's basically one inch, it's basically plus one tack for a lot of engineer models, because a lot of them are tack five. But just that, like, just that little plus one tack buff that just helps you hit the result you want, just that little bit more reliably, is just really cool, especially when your damage results are momentous as well.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And then, you know, the fact that you can throw that momentous on a couple of models, like maybe a Vet Velocity or someone else, you know, she doesn't get the attack buff, but all of a sudden her plus her effective double crowd kind of lend a hand ability.
I think it changes it up, and it makes you consider engineer models that you maybe wouldn't consider as strongly with Ballesta or Penvice.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. So, did you get many games in the play? Obviously, you guys playtested all these internally. My question is, like, how often would you throw out elbow grease? Like, would you do two per turn? Like, what was the kind of common occurrence there?
I usually, when I played her, I think I played her with two games, personally. And elbow grease... Definitely. It's usually the kind of thing you put out, like, at least once per turn. I think Colossus was the model I brought both games, and he got it both games.
Yeah, straight
like,
up.
Pretty much every turn. And then there's quite a few, like as you say, Vet Velocity is a good shout. Salvo, actually, not a terrible shout.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely. Because
it means he has an effective Mom 1 damage double dodge on 1.
Yes.
Or a Mom 2 double dodge on 3. So, like, if you're getting some crowds there, that can actually be pretty good. Mm. Whereas Locus as well makes his 1 and his 3 momentous hoist. Like basically, there's no engineer model that doesn't want that, I think. But Salvo's definitely... it's not Salvo. Colossus is, I think, definitely the one it scales best on.
Yeah. I mean, hoist, I think, and you've probably noticed, I haven't actually looked on the... on Longshanks, but I'm guessing Hoist's pick rate's probably gone down a bit since season 4, and I think Rivet brings him right back into the picture.
I think so.
Yeah, use this plus elbow grease optionally, you know, and then the tack 6 really puts him through the roof. And then if you throw in, like we were throwing around ideas, if you throw in Spade, where you can take the diggy hole, and all of a sudden it's like, ooh, it's going a long way.
Yeah, because you can take diggy hole, and just, you suddenly have that, like, double threat of two-inch melee zone models, like, between him and because, you can use this, and it's like Spade and him are two-inch melee zone models with diggy hole.
Yeah.
So, like, they're suddenly, like, super mobile.
Yeah.
Or you can take, like, singled out off Colossus. He goes in, singles someone out, and then when Colossus goes in, they're already singled out, and you get some crowds so that he can start hitting like the threes and fours on his playbook.
And you make sure you overclock Colossus at that point, so you get the charge attack.
Yeah.
And then, oh, nice! No, I love it. I love everything about this model. One thing to note is, and I know this came out today, but it'll be after, it'll be well and truly into the public, is that the toe has been edited. It's only during her activation. Is that correct?
Yeah. So toe, it's annoyingly easy to miss silly little wording things, especially if no one in playtest points. Like, because we know how a rule is supposed to work, it's very easy for us to just play it like it's supposed to work, and we go, yeah, that's working fine. And then someone like the on the media network or whatever points it out, and we're like, oh, actually, whoops,
yeah,
like, this isn't supposed to be intentional. Although I don't think the version where it wasn't during her activation has ever gone public, actually, because that'll be going out today, and we've already edited that card.
Yeah,
that's going to go out.
Fair. So I'll just completely edit out everything we've just said then. No, that's fine. Well, it actually doesn't even matter. So for those of you, you've never been able to play her that way, would have been fun for you on kickoff, but other than that, like... Nice. I mean, we can still blame Perkins with the... Yeah, for the error.
You can blame most things on Perkins if you try hard enough.
Yeah. Well, you know, Judgment Day, all of these things.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, so Rivet, absolutely love it. I mean, I've been playing a fair whack of miners, but I'll be definitely dancing between them and the engineers, because you can just see so much fun there. And I think that 2-2 game, like, you could always get the 2-2 game with Ballista, but sometimes it had to be Ballista making the killing, whereas now it just kind of opens it up a little bit more. So,
yeah, definitely. Like, you can absolutely, like, she just opens up that kind of, she can, obviously she can also personally do damage. Like, she got 2 damage push on 2 and 3 damage on 4, but she also just turns her team up to 11 and giving Velocity a 2-inch melee zone, and Tax X is, like, real good.
Yeah. Super striker rapping and doing whatever I want. No, it's completely fine.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's plenty of people that are going to love that. Yeah, I mean, the thing there is you're just going to be hitting that tackle double dodge so much more often.
Yeah, definitely. Like, even it just makes it that much more likely, like, on the charge and stuff. Like,
well, the charge, you get the tackle double push double dodge, don't you? You just wrap to the one, and then it's just like, boom, you're going over there, I'm taking the ball, I'm over here, bad luck.
Yeah.
Love it. Into close control models, you tackle double dodge plus the second tackle, even better.
Yeah, it's really good, but, like, the goal-scoring game is, obviously, it's an engineer playstyle, but it doesn't necessarily fit with Rivet's more scrummy playstyle.
No.
So it's not... It's hard playing a little bit outside her comfort zone, and obviously, like, you can't do it on first activation. Or certainly, you can do it with Tactics, but you can't do it with the 2-inch melee.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's setup required, and I kind of like that, I mean, because... From their point of view, they're not meant to be the scrum beater, you know, that end of the spectrum completely. So, you know, unlike the Vet Boars or, you know, the Brewers, those sort of things, these guys require a bit of setup. And then you're kind of telegraphing at that point as well. So,
yeah, definitely. Like, you can't, it's not like it's easy mode, you know?
No.
You still have to work a bit to set up your scrum. It's just easier than it is traditionally for engineers.
Yeah. So, speaking of easy mode, should we just get on to Corbelli? Because this model's been released, and already the salt is flowing on Gubs.
I think the salt is pretty funny on him at the moment.
It's great.
Like, I think he is very good. I think all of these new captains are pretty good. The disproportionate salt levels are strong with this one.
Yeah, and I know we talked about this off air, and obviously we'll go into the model quickly, but it's still, you know, first to 12. It's still like, you know, you score, I score. So, I mean, I've had a few of the locals kind of read the card when it came out and just go, oh, you know, he's better than Shark. I'm like, eh. He doesn't debuff the side like Shark does. He doesn't kind of, you know, restrict the movement. So... Yes, he's going to score a goal, and it's, you know, pretty good odds. But, you know, you've just got to play against him like you would any other kind of goal scorer.
Yeah. Like, that's kind of it. Like, he is a very good goal-scoring model. The other key thing that everyone's going on about how he's better than Shark, which I find quite funny, is that when you look at Shark, he brings, like, Siren or Vet Siren, Sakana or Vet Sakana, Grayscales, Fathom... Like, he has a whole team that supports his goal-scoring strategy, whereas Corbelli has Flint. And then...
That's it.
What, I guess, original Chisel is his next best goal-scoring model because she has an 8-inch sprint and a 2-inch melee.
Yeah. So I guess that takes us to an interesting point of, like, what, you know, obviously you were going for a goal-scoring captain.
Yes.
Number one, why? And number two, you dialed it up to 11, which is great.
So number why for goal-scoring captains, basically because the Masons have the Masons are always supposed to be the quintessential middle of the road guild. Like, they have every option under the sun. Like, none of their players are super dedicated to anything. Well, very, very occasionally, like Hammer is, for instance.
Yeah.
And we already had the kind of two parts of Hammer, who's like the BE captain, Honor, who is the straight middle of the road, true flexible captain, and then Corbelli felt like a very natural inclusion there as the super goal scorer captain, as the third sort of point of the Trinity.
Yeah.
So Masons now have the straight option of like goal scoring, BT or dead like middle of the road with Honor.
Yeah.
And secondly, like dialing them up to 11 is basically because football teams, it's quite hard to make a team that wins by 3 goals.
Yes.
Generally speaking, that is difficult, and so they need to be very good on paper. The other one is that because his team doesn't, as I was just saying, like, his team doesn't support his goal-scoring nature as well as, like, Fish, for example. So he needed something. Like, he needed to be a little bit better there. And the other key thing is that I feel like everyone's looking at making space right now and being like, oh my god, that's insane. It's like, yes, but you need to have the ball.
Yes.
Like, remember when Order didn't have Ball of Light and everyone thought they sucked because half of their abilities didn't work when they have the ball? The most powerful ability on this captain's card doesn't work if he doesn't have the ball.
Yeah, exactly. And it's the one that everyone's going, but what if... Yeah, no, I completely agree. Situationally, you know, if you're playing a football game, you're going to have the ball half the time, and then it's not always going to be on him. So, you know, the volume of dodges isn't actually going to be that high.
Yeah, don't get me wrong, there's going to be a lot of dodges, but because I think we all know that when a football team plays, it usually is they score a goal, they then don't have the ball for a while, and then they're trying to get the ball and score in one activation because their win condition has to come from goals. I think Corbelli can maybe get a couple of takeouts against like squishier teams.
Yeah.
But like particularly if you kind of build his lineup for it. But then you still need, I think, at least 2 goals to win with Corbelli. And if you don't have the ball, you don't have making space, and you need to get the ball and score in one activation generally. There's a lot of panic and salt about him right now that will not be borne out on the tabletop.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, my argument with the Shark comparison is that, you know, they score, you score. Well, okay, so if they score a goal, you just have to score one at the end of the turn, win the momentum race and score again. Like, it's not, you know, he can only score once per turn. He doesn't, you know, it's not like he's got Yuko and his team where, you know, you can have back-to-back goals straight away if you can even engineer that situation. So, because the support's less, if you've played into Shark and a good, you know, Fish player, well, actually, like you said, you've got those support models that threat other parts of the pitch. Whereas Corbelli, I mean, I haven't really looked too deep into what kind of support you'd give him. But from my point of view, I think you'd be giving him, you know, obviously Flint, but then probably defensive players. So really, your ball retrieval, I know he's got an insane one, but no one else has got it other than Flint. So it seems to be that I reckon it would be harder to hide the ball.
Yes.
Easier to hide the ball, harder for him to get the ball.
Yeah, I think it is easier to hide the ball against a Corbelli lineup than it is against the Shark lineup.
Yes.
The other one that's worth mentioning is that compared to Shark, who can, if he needs to, he can move, 13 inches in a turn prior to any playbook dodges.
Yeah.
Corbelli can only move 10, and that's a sprint and acrobatic, and then he's having to, with tack 5, try and hit that like second column for a double dodge
for
result.
Big double dodges, and yeah.
It's also worth mentioning that he has one more tack than Shark as well.
Yeah.
And particularly if you start hitting like a 4-1 model in cover, because his knockdown is trash. Like, Corbelli's knockdown is trash. So if you're hitting a 4-1 model in cover, you're in no way... You shouldn't be hitting that double dodge.
No.
In any way reliably, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, so that extra threat range is almost non-existent, right?
Yeah.
Not non-existent, but you're going to get the single dodges. I mean, it seems like he plays a similar way to Shark, where, you know, you roll a bunch of dice, it doesn't matter the result, because you just take the momentous dodge on the one.
Yeah. Yeah, you're either going for the mom tackle, the mom dodge, yeah. Really on one. And it's just handy. Like, he is a very strong captain, don't get me wrong, because we try and always make captains strong, because...
Surprise, they're an important part of the game.
Yeah, like, that's part of why the game's fun, right? And that's a big part of the game, but it's one I definitely don't think the salt is warranted on this one.
Yeah, no, for any cooler, like, janky plays you've seen, like, him done in the playtest, or you've played with him? I mean, obviously, you've been spread across multiple models, so...
Yeah, I don't feel like I've unlocked him fully through playtest, but the key thing, like, if he does have making space up, like, if his team does have the ball, it is really cool just dodging all of your models around the pitch. Although, of course, each model can only dodge once per turn.
Yeah.
As a result of that. But just dodging everyone around and adding to threat ranges and pulling someone back if they're in danger, like, that's all just really cool. Like, it's really, really good, but obviously he then doesn't have the ball. Like, if he scores, he doesn't have the ball anymore. So it's a real, you have to, I think, with Corbelli, consider when you want to score as well. Like, that's really important.
Yeah, because I think it really just pushes them to a 2-2. Like, I mean, he can go full in football, but I don't know. I just feel like his 3-0 game would take too long for him to get the 3 goals.
I think that's often true. Like, I think against some teams, like Alchemists or... Navigators, even where their players were a bit squishier, he can maybe push for a 2-2. But then there's other teams, like I think against Butchers, I think they kill him too fast.
Yes. Yeah.
For him to kill models back. And I think against like Brewers, they're just too tough for him to kill.
Yeah, okay. So then, like, he's got to err on the 3-0.
Yeah. So he is on that borderline of being, he can flex from a 3-0 to a 2-2 game depending on what the situation requires.
Yeah. No, I love it. I love the space he fills. I haven't actually played that much Masons, but I know a few mates who like seen, looked at him and gone, right, I'm going to buy a full Mason side, let's go.
Yeah.
And I think also from a freshness point of view, and I don't know if you guys actually look at this, but it feels like we've seen less Masons around the place, and this will give them a bit of, you know, obviously there's so much new stuff going out, but this will give them a bit of life in terms of, you know, seeing them at more events.
I think part of it is because, like, so Masons are always supposed to be able to flex into whatever they need to do to win the game, whether that's, like, potentially 6 takeouts against some teams or 1-4, 2-2, 3-0. Like, Masons have that, like, they are pure middle of the road. They can flex into doing whatever you need them to do. But for a long time, for the last, like, couple of releases for Masons, we've been buffing their kind of defensive aura, scrummy fighty builds, and we haven't really buffed their football at all. Like, Flint's really their only player that's like an out and out footballer. So we basically swung the needle a little bit too far in Masons towards fightiness, and I think part of the reason you maybe don't see that many Masons about is just fatigue a little bit with that, like, that kind of play style, because that is the, I think, best way to play them currently. And Corbelli's an attempt to kind of shake that up and be like, no, these guys are supposed to have good footballing options as well.
Yeah,
and it's an attempt to deliberately push that side of Masons that has been a little bit ignored for the last couple of years.
Was that an identification of like a meta shift as well? I mean, you know, the fighty kind of scrum football, you know, especially end of season 3, that was just the, you know, standard kind of way of playing the game, or at least, you know, more controlled way. And now it's swinging back to more football. So you've kind of gone that way. But the models you did previously were just edging towards that fightiness because the game was kind of going that way?
Yeah, I think we sort of let ourselves get a little bit blinkered by how the game was developing and maybe not kind of taking a step back and looking at the broader picture of Masons. We're kind of like, we let ourselves get led down a path a little bit. And so with Corbelia, we sort of took a step back and went, actually, no, this isn't what we want to do with Mason. Like, we don't want to pigeonhole them into that kind of defensive aura, fighty, scrummy style of play. We want to give them, we want to push their footballing options as well. So yeah, I think definitely it was, it's a sign of the times.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. That's probably a good way of like, So we've seen all the captains. What are we missing? Obviously you're not going to tell me, you know, specifically who they are. But the third captains, we've still got to come. Alchemists.
Yeah,
farmers. Is that it?
And Union.
Union. Oh, of course, because they lost one, you know, sadly. They were the original three-captain guild.
Yeah, they were the first three-captain guild, and then we ended up taking that off them, unfortunately.
No, which is fair. Is there any... In terms of the OPD and like captain selection, you're happy with the 2 captain 12 model kind of setup?
Yeah, certainly for now. Like, it's something we might look at in future, but for now we're not intending on changing that at all.
Is the 12 model, is that freeing up, you know, pick rates and kind of you're seeing more of those niche models?
Yeah, to an extent. Like, I like that I've seen people in Season 4 saying that, like, they've got 12 model rosters and they still don't know which models they want to drop.
Yeah.
And that's really cool, because that is the intent, is that you should have to make meaningful choices within your 12. And then again, every time you play a game, you're having to make meaningful choices regarding, like, which models you bring, which models you don't bring. So yeah, I think absolutely. I think that's having the desired effect at the moment. Mm. But it's obviously something we keep an eye on, like as the game it's something we're pretty much constantly keeping an eye on as the game develops.
So from a miner's point of view, as in minor guilds' point of view, you should just limit their rosters to 7 models, and they've got to make a choice then.
No, they're already punished enough by not having 12.
You're not talking about the miners specifically then? Because, I mean, speaking of salt, and maybe we can transition over to that, but I also appreciate there might be limited things you can say. The miners seem to be super powerful and prevalent at the moment.
I think it's interesting looking at... So when people first saw the miners compared to when people first saw Vet Boar, everyone went nuts about Vet Boar on paper, and then having played him... Like, having seen, like, Vengeance and French Nats and Adepticon, like, Vet Boar's obviously very, very good, but he's not achieved that sort of domination that miners have. And whereas miners, on paper, people didn't quite get how good they were. And it's an interesting one, because with minor guilds, we tend to try and skew it a little bit more powerful than major guilds in the first instance, because like Navigators are a perfect example of where for the first month they have like a 58% win rate or something, and then people figure out what to do and they drop down. And so we know that happens with minor guilds, so we generally try and skew them now a little bit more powerfully. And I think we just overshot the mark slightly with miners. Like, I don't think it's any big thing that is broken about them. I think it's just a couple of their levers are perhaps a notch or two too high. And obviously we said on Monday, like at time of recording, we're going to be looking at them over the next month and releasing an errata towards the end of April, which I don't think will need to be especially big. I think there are certain levers we just bring down like one notch.
Yeah.
And I think that's okay.
Yeah. And like, I think there's a few I could identify having played them a few times that I think, you know, are super good, but also probably don't need to be that good. I mean, the first one that comes to mind is, and I'm not sure, I'm making a massive assumption here, but Fissure, and being able to, the come with me, being able to do that on Shaft's Legendary, I'm guessing that wasn't necessarily intended. And maybe it was, but probably doesn't need to be. You know, the fact that Shaft can go from his own deployment, whereas you can still do similar thing, but just further up the pitch, just means that you've got to risk Shaft before you do it.
Yeah, for sure. I don't think that needs to be. That's just, as I say, it's a little example of us leaning towards going slightly more powerful. But that's one that I don't think. I think you might be right there. That may not need to be.
No, look, I get you can't obviously comment. I'm making the assumption you're probably playtesting at the moment anyway, so you wouldn't even know what the final ones would be. So.
Yeah, I can't comment on specifics or anything, but yeah, like there are certain points there where I think there are a couple of wee things we can tweak down because the one thing we don't want to do is impact the core flavor of the guild and the core design.
Yeah,
like we won't be tinkering with that per se. We'll be looking at things around that and, you know, maybe reducing a few numbers, maybe whatever needs to happen.
Yeah.
You know, like we're like those of like those changes will all be tested and stuff as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think a wider thing, and I think it was Juan Sims made this point on his blog, that balance is so difficult in Guild Ball because the rest of the game is very balanced. Like for March, there was a 10% difference between the highest win rate and the lowest win rate for all of the other guilds except Miners. So because balance is so delicate, if we get it off even like by like 10% or 5%, that's a huge swing. And it looks way worse than it is, if you get me.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a massive skew. And if you actually take that, you know, in terms of number of games win 1 out of 10, like it's, you know, oh, okay, this guild on average wins 6 out of 10 and that one's 7 out of 10. It actually doesn't seem like that much, but on a power kind of curve, that is quite a bit when everything's bunched in the middle. Do you guys look at this when you filter on Longshanks to the player rankings, like stat filter? Because I reckon someone pointed out to me that if you actually do that with the Miners, to kind of take out, you know, not saying the lower players or the newer players, if you filter that out, you can actually show that Miners, like the win rate when you're playing high level against high level players, it actually drops considerably. So it goes down by almost 10%. So, which would indicate to me that, yeah, that's still very high, but it's, you know, in more comfortable kind of zone.
Yeah, for sure. Like it's something that we do pay attention to, is like how many good players, I guess, and how many like top tier players are playing this guild. And what do their, like, as you say, how do their figures match up against, like, other good players? Because a relatively small number, at least, of good players playing a guild. Like, because I think with Miners, it was a lot of people went, oh, these are really cool, I want to play them. And that was almost, not irrespective of balance, because obviously people are like, these are really good as well. But a bunch of top players, particularly for French Nationals, went, these are cool, I'm taking these guys.
Yeah.
And if you look at the people that obviously came like top 8 or top 10 at French Nationals, all of those are very good players.
Yeah.
Almost all of them are very, very good players who historically do very well in events anyway. So I definitely think that, I think there's the thing with Miners, because they play jankalier, to coin a terrible phrase, they play jankalier than any other team in the game, and you need to get your head around how their threat ranges and how their team works. And so, much like the Navigators, I think we will start to see a natural decline in their win rate over the next sort of month or so anyway, but it does also seem like we need to take we do need to bring them down a little, I think, but the key thing is that we don't overreact.
Yeah.
Because it would be very easy to just kill them entirely competitively, and that's not what we want to do at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like you said, you know, their threat ranges and angles are so varied. I think the best thing to do would be to actually play them. So if you've got someone at the club, like, play them and then swap over and play against them, or vice versa. Because then you understand what the flaws are. Because I've been, you know, quite vocal in trying to point out how I suggest you should play against them. And people are like, no, you can't kill them fast enough. I'm like, yeah, but maybe you don't want to be killing them. You know, maybe you want to play the football faster. You know, there are other ways around that problem. And I think it starts with like, understanding them.
Yeah, they're like any goal-scoring team with regards to they don't love being counter-scored on.
No.
Because, like, if you look at the game as, like, they're going to score three goals, but that's fine. Or they're going to try and score three goals, but that's fine because every time they give me the ball, I'll just counter-score. And in the meantime, I'll try and kill a couple of players or something like that, you know? And especially because they like to try for ring-outs, so that means their players are going to be near the edge of the pitch as well.
Yeah.
And none of them have stoic, none of them have sturdy. Like, they don't have any defence against just getting pushed off the pitch as well. So, like, if you're looking at Mule and going, oh, he's really hard to kill, it's like, yeah, but he likes hanging about 5 inches from the edge of the pitch. So, you know, like, yes, he's really tough, but just get your own pushes in there.
Yeah, absolutely. I've found I actually have thrown way fewer models off the table than I thought I would with him just because of that reason. I just don't want him near the edge. I'd actually rather him around the middle. You know, throwing people, locking them down. I mean, you know, my favourite's when you can, you know, KD lockdown throw someone into, like, rough ground and just go, see you later. Have fun with that.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. Yeah. he's such a good model, isn't he?
Oh, he's fantastic. He's so good.
He's a big boy.
No, he's fantastic. Yeah. So, yeah, no, I'm loving some miners at the moment. But, yeah, I'll be interested to see, you know, from a gamer's point of view. I mean, I used to play Alchemists years ago, and well, I still do, but when Midas could still scything blow, and there's a point at which we all acknowledge that something shouldn't be in the game or is powered slightly too high, and I think, you know, we all agree that there's something about the Midas that just needs to dial back a little bit, but I think it's still very, very early days.
Yes, and that's why we're going to take like another month and kind of just test what the changes are. And because I think the win rate will start naturally dropping anyway, we don't want to overdo it. Like, it's the kind of key thing. We don't want to over nerf here.
No, fair. And that, I mean, that should be a general rule of kind of, you know, any guild and any kind of gaming company. You don't want to go over the, you know, too high or too low. You ultimately want balance anyway. So,
yeah, definitely. Like, we want basically every single win rate to be as close to 50% as possible.
Is on the, you know, playing the devil's advocate there, do you, you know, you kind of want a little bit of variation there, though? Or, you know, the variations in the playstyle, and if everything was, you know, within 2% of 50, that would be ideal?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, yes. Like, we're never going to get everything at 50, yeah, and you do want variation due to playstyle, but like ultimately you want every win rate to be as close to 50% as possible, and obviously like there are going to be guilds where that's going to be higher or lower because they're more difficult to play. So Blacksmiths, for instance, which I don't know if you guys have paid attention to the kind of Scottish, like Fraser, Allen, Steve Easton in Scotland, where they reckon Blacksmiths are like the best team in the game. Their win rate with them is ridiculous. Like they're smashing events right now. But Blacksmiths still have like a 47% win rate or something because they are tricky to play that well, you know?
No, I haven't paid attention to that, but I'm slightly scared by Scottish Beeston. 47. I'm even looking at Rats at 44. Like that seems horrendously low.
Yeah, but like you're talking about like Rats are at 44 or whatever, but if you look at the highest win rate, or like certainly for March, the highest win rate in the game was Butchers at like 53.
Yeah.
So that's not even 10%.
No, I mean that's low from a point of view of I feel like they're stronger than that, but they probably fall into the same category as Blacksmiths where they are just trickier.
Yeah, they're just a bit like, and because of how we design certain guilds, like rat catchers, like Blacksmiths, there will always be, I think, certain guilds that will have a lower win rate. Like, their top level win rate will be very good, but their overall win rate won't be spectacular because you need to put a, you need to put quite a lot in to get the most out of them.
Yeah.
If you get me.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, an entry-level player that comes in and goes to a tournament might not do so well just because of the complexity and that, you know, skews the results down. Absolutely.
Yeah. Whereas, like, anyone can pick up Butchers and do pretty well with them because Butchers are, like, probably the lowest skill floor in the game in terms of, like, I want to run at things and hit them and I get rewarded for doing so.
Well, it's the easiest transition from other miniature games, too. It's, like, what most people are used to doing.
Yeah, because it's funny watching people who are used to, like, coming from other war games and they start playing Guild Ball and they're like, right, so I just hit you. I just hit you, and then they kill two models and lose 12-4 because someone went, no, I'm going to score three goals.
Yeah, and they don't even bother trying to stop them.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, yeah, you can kill two of my models, fine. I don't care. Like, and getting people used to the fact that goal scoring is a huge, is one of the most important aspects of Guild Ball is something that I think all new players take a bit of time to learn.
Yeah.
Because, especially if they're coming from other war games, which are purely based on killing.
Yeah. I think we've all spent time, like, punching people with shark and not realising that you just score goals instead.
Yeah. I think everyone's done that for, like, a game and then realised that they're playing the game wrong.
Yeah, yeah. I think it took me a couple, but that was, yeah, early, early days. And that was busted shark, too. That was so good.
Oh, yeah. Back in the day.
We actually had, I had a local suggest that we have a day where you can bring out one of your Season 1 captain's cards. And you can just buy them like that. I was like, yeah. But then we're going to see some, you know, the Obulus, the Midas sharks going to come out. It might be fun.
Scything Blow Midas again.
Scything Blow Midas. You're going to see, you know, 8 influence Obulus basically just tearing up the pitch.
Yeah. Oh, back in the day.
Okay. I might actually do it. It might be fun. Who knows? So Bryce, have you got any other anything else you want to say as the leader of the free world before we sign off?
Well, it's lambing season, so everyone make sure and get out, bring your sheep in, check the ewes because they will be lambing just now, so make sure and do your rounds every morning and at lunch and at night. If there's any ewes that you think might have a bit of problems, take your quad bike out in the middle of the night, go check them because you don't want to lose those lambs. Make sure you've got newspaper in the kitchen in case some of the lambs need to come inside because they will shit everywhere.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
And yeah, so generally just look after your animals.
That's some quality farming advice there. Do you run like alpacas or... you know, anything to keep, like, the predators away, the foxes away, especially around this time? You don't?
No, we don't actually have a lot of problems with foxes and stuff. Crows, actually, weirdly, are quite often way worse than foxes.
How big
foxes
are your crows? Like,
because the thing is, they go for the eyes. So they come in, so, like, you can have a ewe that'll have a couple of lambs, and, like, if a fox comes near, the ewe just charges it, and the fox is like, no, I'm going to get out of here. But a crow is much harder to defend against for a ewe. So the crow comes in and pecks out the lamb's eyes, and then the lamb dies.
Ah. It's not very nice.
Sorry, this has got really darkly specific into farmer chat right now.
It did. But, I mean, you know, that's what you're here for. I mean, that's essentially why you're... I can't remember what the title is. Family. Head of the family. That's the one.
Head of the family.
Outstanding in the field and in the kitchen. Well, Mr. Bryce Johnson... thank you very much for your time. We will chat again soon. I appreciate like coming on the cast, mate.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. Like, big fan of you guys. Always like coming on.
Yeah, I mean, everyone likes time traveling into the future. That's what I say.
Yeah, it's great because you're on Wednesday night.
Yeah,
right?
It's almost 10 o'clock Wednesday night. Yeah.
Oh gosh, my heavens! How is the future?
It was a really good day today. It was really sunny outside. Yeah, it's nice.
I made the mistake of, because I was in France, obviously for French at the weekend, and it was like 20 degrees. Like, it was really nice and warm and sunny for March. And then I came home and like was like, oh no, I live in England and it's grey. And I wore a hood. I didn't put on a jacket on Monday to go to work, and I was just shivering in my car the whole way. And I was like, God, this stupid country. I hate it so much.
And you're in spring. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I lived there for a couple of years. My wife and I, and I just remember, yeah, there's just this 9 month period where you don't see the sky at all, and then the sun comes out for three non-sequential weeks, and that's it. So no, I think it was at that point I went, I'm either slitting my wrists or like coming home.
Yeah, I get that. Like, it was actually, it's actually quite nice though, because it's now not dark when I leave work. Like, because for a long time there, it was like dark when I got to work and dark when I left work, and I was like, this is miserable. But it's actually now, like, there's actually still daylight when I leave work, so that's quite nice.
Yes. I think there's definitely something in the fact that humans need daylight.
Yeah. Everyone, apparently everyone in the UK should have, like, vitamin D supplements, because we're all vitamin D deprived, apparently.
Probably.
Like, permanently. Like, maybe that's what's screwing the country up so much right now.
I mean, I could point at a few of your political leaders, but yeah, we'll go with vitamin D is the main cause.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting theory. Like, who knows? And pretending it's something other than terrible leadership means, you know, I can pretend that there's a fix.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. That would be nice.
It would. I did see a April Fool's Day joke where someone said they'd reverse Brexit, and I just thought, actually, that's a really mean April Fool's Day joke. That's not even funny.
Yeah, that's so mean. Like, that's not funny, because I want that so badly.
Yeah, I know. I think you and the rest of the world, barring a couple of people like Theresa. Anyway, we won't get into that political chat.
Anyway, yes.
Thank you very much for your time, sir.
Yeah, thank you very much for your time. It's grand to be on. Nice to speak to you again.
You too. Welcome back. That was a great little chat with Bryce. Thank you very much again, Bryce, for your time. Really appreciate it. I guess it's great for Steamforged and their design team to be able to get out there and chat to all the different podcasts and at least, you know, give their angle on what they're doing. And I think they're, you know, really transparent in the way they do that. A few thanks. Obviously, freecitygames.com. Jesse is a legend. He's dished out some vouchers to a local rookie league that I've just finished running. An absolute champion of the community here, and he's always supporting events. So jump on freecitygames.com and use DoubleDodge10 as your promo code, and you get 10% off. Also, I'd love to plug the Patreon if you want to support us. It's patreon.com/DoubleDodge. There's usually a link in the show notes. And yeah, there's different levels of subscription. We send you stuff out, but really it's our appreciation for just helping us out and, you know, cover the costs of hosting and that sort of thing. Because obviously we like doing it, but it's not free and it's quite time-consuming. We like sending stuff out, and we often like then use the money to then put it back into community events and that sort of thing. So that would be greatly appreciated. The one last thing I want to plug, I think our good mate Pash, Scottish Pash, has asked us to plug the Highlander Cup, which is the first Scottish National Championship. So it's backed by Steamforge. Basically means the winner will be offered the opportunity to basically represent Scotland in the Gilboa World Championship, which is bloody awesome. So the event, from what I understand, is on the 25th and 26th of May at Common Ground Games in Stirling. So basically, if you go to commongroundgames.co.uk, the full schedule will be there. This is assuming that all the details are still the same. If things have changed, maybe just jump online, hit up Pash, because he's an absolute legend. I'm sure he'll answer any questions for you. So yeah, get on in there. It's great to see, like, you know, more and more of these national championships to really fill out what will be, you know, an even bigger kind of world pool and really refine down to, you know, who are the best players. So other than that, hope you enjoyed the episode, and we'll be back shortly with something else which will resemble somewhat of a shit show. We'll be right back.
Fair. Yep.